Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by author and journalist John Beck, and we discuss his book, Those Who Should Be Seized, which takes a look at China's persecution of Uyghurs in the Xinjiang region. I hope you find this episode interesting. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
John, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. So thank you. So for the benefit of listeners, please can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what inspired you to write your book, Those Who Should Be Seized?
So I'm a writer and a journalist, and I focus mostly over the years on writing long-form magazine pieces on human rights issues and conflict, working in Iraq, in Ukraine, in Syria, Egypt, and various other places. But I lived in Istanbul for quite a few years, which is where I began the reporting that led to this book, because it's home to the largest Uyghur diaspora population outside of Kazakhstan. Estimates vary, but probably around 50,000. And the book, Those Who Should Be Seized, it's a narrative nonfiction. And it follows the stories of four people, two Uyghurs and two members of China's ethnic Kazakh minority, who were all from Xinjiang and were caught up in China's campaign of repression against Turkic Muslims there. They all escaped China eventually, but they found themselves pursued by the Chinese security apparatus all around the world, all the way to the US, in fact, to New York and DC as well. But like, just for background, before we go any further, the facts of what China has done and is doing to Muslim minorities in Xinjiang are fairly well established now, very well established, particularly the intensified crackdown that began in 2016 and 2017. And that's, thanks to the work of many human rights organizations, many journalists, as well as, leaked Chinese government documents as well. It's a campaign to erase whole peoples and identities, mass detention in camps and in prisons, surveillance state of unprecedented size, and we could talk a bit more about that later, forced labor, torture, family separations, forced sterilization, and many other abuses besides. The US, Canadian, Dutch governments have all called it genocide, as have a number of human rights groups, and even the UN, which is obviously very careful in the way it phrases things, said a couple of years ago that it could all constitute crimes against humanity. And as this relates to the book, I began talking to Uyghurs in Istanbul not too long after the crackdown began. And many of the people I spoke with there were studying or working in Turkey, and suddenly discovered that they could no longer return home because spending time abroad was enough for the government to consider them a person of suspicion. So it was very likely they'd be detained if they even tried. Other reasons for detention, by the way, for people in Xinjiang could include growing a beard or quitting smoking or drinking, saying God bless you in a text message or any number of other things like that. But back in Istanbul, as we talked about what was happening in Xinjiang, they'd mentioned the harassment that they experienced in Turkey from Chinese authorities. They already knew that to contact family members, wives, even wives and husbands and children, you're the people you love the most, would put them at danger of arrest as well. So often they just stopped speaking with them, no matter how much they missed them, because to do so would endanger them. But in 2018, some people started telling me they'd been getting calls from people who said they were police or Communist Party cadres, and told them that if they did want to speak to their family, they could do it through them. The handlers wanted things in exchange, though it wasn't just a service. They wanted exiles to provide addresses in Istanbul, maybe pictures of their children if they had any, to go to the consulate in Istanbul and to, you know, say that they were still Chinese citizens. And obviously people in Istanbul were worried that they would then be kidnapped if they did do that. But that all came with veiled, or I mean, sometimes not very veiled threats about what would happen to their loved ones back in Xinjiang if they refused. The common phrase was to say, you know, you must think of your family because they're here and, you know, you're far away. Basically, the repercussions of any disobedience would be, you know, visited on them. And maybe if the exile provided some of that information, they might have a chance to speak with those loved ones on a video call. And the calls were supervised. Often there was an obvious presence just off screen. And everyone back home said that everything was wonderful. Everyone was happy, that there were new jobs, new houses. Everyone was making good money. And, you know, as obviously false as all that was, if that's the only way that you can speak to your family, it's better than nothing at all. And then the request would escalate. It would be, do you know any Uyghurs who are members of cultural associations? I don't necessarily mean overtly political cultural associations. I mean, it could do with language, you know, literature, but that was seen as political in itself. And then the handler would ask them to go along to one of those meetings, to report on who was there, to take pictures. And if they did that too, they might get another call home. And I spoke to dozens of Uyghurs in Istanbul, and I'm not sure a single one of them had escaped completely from those kind of contacts. I don't mean activists, because if you were an activist, things were much harder still when you were subjected to a very sort of concerted campaign. And the more people I spoke to, the more common I realized it was and how effective it was too, because it spread this. I mean, most people, the vast majority, refused to do what was asked of them, but it spread this very justified paranoia through the diaspora community, because if everyone had been approached, then everyone was a potential spy. And the only people who really understood what they were going through couldn't be trusted. So it was chilling, and it was something I wanted to, I mean, it was extraordinary. And it was something that I wanted to cover more. And I wrote a couple of articles, one for National Geographic, another for Harper's, that followed the story of a man who eventually ended up in the book. And yeah, that's kind of how things started. Things then kept getting worse afterwards. An Uyghur who told journalists about being forced to spy on other Uyghurs was actually shot in the street in Turkey. He survived, but, you know, badly injured. And the police never found the culprit. And so, yeah, I kept covering, I kept speaking to people, and eventually it became a book. And that then went on to, you know, the same kind of, I mean, the book follows, as I said, people from Xinjiang onto Kazakhstan and the US. And I found that those same things were happening too in New York and in DC, in Virginia, where there's a big Uyghur population. And that was sort of a key theme that I wanted to get across, the sense that for many in the diaspora and for other minorities as well, one way or another, the Chinese state was always with them. They could never really be free because it could, you know, reach them anywhere they were.
And is that the origin behind the title of the book, Those Who Should Be Seized?
The title actually comes from a speech that Xi Jinping gave in 2014. He likened the situation in Xinjiang to a patient with heart disease. And he said that the medicine required was a correct view of the motherland, of the nation, and that this medicine would support the correct and remove the evil, as he said. The full quote goes, regarding those who violate the law, those who should be seized, and those who should be sentenced should be sentenced. And the idea of a correct view of the nation sums up, I think, a lot of the motivation of what authorities were doing and went on to do, that to align thought with the government's own, and that anyone outside of that very sort of narrow band of accepted thought should be rounded up and re-educated.
Yeah, it's quite a chilling thought, that, because I think there's a lot of people out there who don't really have any idea what it's actually like to live in the police state. I've never directly experienced it, but I certainly read a bit about it and can use my imagination. But it sounds horrific, kind of carrying that paranoia with you all the time. Out of interest, so we have a lot of listeners who are would-be writers or students, and I was just wondering if you wouldn't mind, how do you go about kind of researching a topic like this and kind of finding people to reach out to who are kind of, that you can verify, etc.? How does that work?
I mean, it's a long process for something like this. People are understandably leery of talking to you often. So, I mean, starting in Istanbul was a case of speaking with people who would speak with me. hoping that they would then introduce me to other people, building trust and confidence, doing a bit of reporting that then becomes a bit of a calling card for you. And yeah, just a process of building and building. But it takes time. Of course it does. People are, as I said, very justly paranoid and very afraid. And you also absolutely don't want to endanger them in any way. A process essentially.
Yeah. And did you ever feel yourself under surveillance from the Chinese government during your research?
I think it's always wise to assume that you might be surveilled and to use the most secure avenues of communication available to you. But I mean, even if I wasn't under surveillance, certainly some of the people that I was speaking with likely were. So it's good practice anyway to take all the precautions that you can. And obviously I did do that here.
Yeah. So in your reporting, how did you see the Chinese state weaponize bureaucracy into tools of control?
I think you could spend a whole podcast talking just about this, but the same tools that would be used to form the basis of general state functions were turned to means of repression. If you look at identity cards, for example, back in 2014, there was a new kind of ID card in Xinjiang called a People's Convenience Card. It functioned essentially like an internal passport to be shown at checkpoints, long-distance trains, that kind of thing. But they had to be obtained from hometowns. So in big cities in Xinjiang, like Urumqi, the regional capital, there are lots of internal migrants from smaller towns and villages, Uyghurs, Kazakhs, many other minorities. The Han Chinese living in Xinjiang tended to get those cards pretty easily and often remotely. But Uyghurs often had to travel back home to apply. And then they, again, would quite often find that their applications had been denied. So when they arrived, they just had to remain where they were, a way of controlling them stranding them in their hometowns. But then later on, the issuing of identity cards was turned into a method to collect biometric data. This was the sort of third generation ID cards, they called them. But that was really detailed data, blood type, DNA, fingerprints, retinal scans, even voice patterns. Basically, all of the information you would need to introduce a system, like an unprecedented system of surveillance to track almost everything. But then otherwise, I mean, local housing committees would issue announcements saying residents should volunteer to have their phones scanned for harmful content. And then that would involve having monitoring software installed too. There would be flag-raising ceremonies every week. And Uyghur residents would have to present themselves in the courtyard and form into rows and sing the national anthem. There was also something called the Join Up and Become Family scheme, which was incredibly sinister. It sent party cadres to live with Uyghur families in their homes to share their food, even bedrooms, beds sometimes, and make really detailed reports about their behavior, questioning them individually, even the children, for signs of religious activity, their attitudes toward the government, things like that. The school system, obviously schools, particularly under repressive governance, but not only so, are often a way of enforcing national identity and loyalty. But in Xinjiang, it also became a means to separate children from their parents, particularly if the parents had been arrested. The children would be sent to these residential boarding schools. And they were designed also to assimilate and to indoctrinate, and children had to speak Chinese, not Uyghur or Kazakh. It's obviously kind of reminiscent of the way Canada and the US treated indigenous children. And the scale is enormous, though. At least 500,000, I think, children were sent to these schools. Culture, too. People in detention camps told me Uyghur imams were brought in to essentially tell them not to follow the tenets of Islam. And then you have the destruction of mosques and Muslim cemeteries, often the name of rebuilding a certain neighborhood or something like that. And then a new tourist campaign to get people to visit Xinjiang. They're talking about beautiful Xinjiang, talking about how happy people are there, and sometimes doing that with the help of useful influencers, let's say. And that often involves videos and images of people dancing in sort of approximations of traditional dress, but not as a living culture. It's like some people have described as Disneyfication of Uyghur and Kazakh traditions, and authorities are sort of using that, promoting that in lieu of the culture they're trying to eradicate.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny you used the term Disneyfication, because I think a Disney movie did actually film in the region, didn't it, and cause some controversy.
It did, indeed.
Was that Mulan, wasn't it?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, one of the most haunting elements in your book is how quickly kind of normal actions such as owning a book or growing a beard become grounds for suspicion. So how does this shifting red line function in authoritarian regimes?
So in China and Xinjiang, there were times, you know, like the Cultural Revolution and the recent crackdown, when things were incredibly strict, incredibly rigid, incredibly repressive. And then there were times of reform when there were relatively more freedoms. In Xinjiang, there'd been forms of kind of bending the law that had been permitted. For example, foreign television series, often Turkish, where, you know, you could buy VCDs in marketplaces. Books that weren't necessarily officially approved could be bought too. Forms of religious expression that were legally permitted, but, you know, that was allowed. But then when things sort of tightened again, especially during the, you know, during the recent crackdown, those freedoms became almost a means of trapping people. Syra, one of the people whose story is included in the book, she was invited to be part of a state delegation promoting trade in Kazakhstan and Russia and Mongolia. But then when things became more restrictive, her having left the country appeared to be the actual reason she was arrested. And the same went for people studying abroad or who had children studying abroad, even if they'd gone to visit them, even if it had all been legally and approved by the government. Sarah was held in the camp with two traditional dancers that she knew, and they weren't really religious, but an evening in 2014, they had gone to visit the home of a friend and a musician to cook and talk and make music. But that was during Ramadan, not that they were particularly observant of it, but in 2017, the police called them in and said that they were on security camera footage celebrating an Islamic festival, and that was the reason for the detention. So, yeah.
And what role does digital surveillance play in Xinjiang? And do you think it's a prototype for wider use inside and even outside China?
Yeah, excellent question. So mass surveillance and mass collection of data is obviously happening around the world. But China is usually considered, I think rightly, you know, the world's largest surveillance state. And Xinjiang is an especially heavily surveilled, especially concentrated version of that. Residents can expect, you know, every movement, every word to be monitored. And it's so effective that even though, as I'm sure you've seen, China has now reduced the number of detainees, you know, in Xinjiang camps and prisons. But when I speak to exiled Uyghurs in the US, in Europe, in the UK, they believe that people back home have effectively begun policing their own behavior to make sure that it's in line with the government, because they know that everything they do is being observed. So they've, I mean, built their own prisons, if you know what I mean, because any breach of that would get them detained. There's been lots of suggestions that China's turned Xinjiang into a sort of test lab for future control in the rest of the country. And I mean, that is proving true in a number of ways. You know, technology like Wi-Fi sniffers, facial recognition. And during the pandemic, there was an expansion of surveillance methods and control that was first seen there as well. Which is also being expanded outside China too. You know, Chinese firms are marketing and exporting various tools that have been used there. Some of them under this Safe City banner, marketing them to other governments, you've probably seen. And, you know, you might also remember the Chinese-backed finance, rather, African Union headquarters building in Ethiopia, which turned out to be packed with surveillance devices. So it's very much spreading out too.
Yeah, and are there any Western companies involved in that sort of technology, or is at least some of that technology being sold to Western companies?
Not used internally, but there have been, I mean, a number of European countries in the UK, I guess, if you've seen, have decided not to work with Chinese companies that have been involved in Xinjiang surveillance, but also for their own, after the African Union debacle, have decided that it's not secure for them to use them. They banned, you know, Chinese firms from involvement in national security or national networks.
Yeah, yeah. I know Huawei in particular is one that stood out as that got banned in the US and in the UK because they were going to provide a certain level of infrastructure for 5G that was, not good.
That's a great example. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take a break and be right back with more. Hey, everybody, it's Chris here. I hope you're well. Have you ever wanted to run one of your own podcasts? Well, on Monday, the 22nd of September, I'll be running a one-day workshop with my friend Jeff, who runs a Doctor Who podcast called Who Corner to Corner. And we'll be looking at the basics of podcasting and empowering you to make your own podcast. So join us on Monday, the 22nd of September. The link is in the show notes below. Throughout the book, books are hidden, stories are whispered, and poems are passed from hand to hand. Why do you think literature and memory are seen as such a threat by the Chinese state?
I mean, I think you can sort of look. I mean, this is a program of cultural eradication, right? And I think you can look at culture as, you know, in many ways, a sort of shared memory passed down, through generations and generations. And poetry, writing, stories are ways to preserve that memory. Mm. So if you're trying to eradicate a culture, they're often the first things to be targeted. And, you know, you saw that in the Soviet Union as well. Intellectuals, writers were usually the first to go. And for Uyghurs and for Chinese Kazakhs, literature already had a very prominent cultural position. But as that existed since the formation of China in its current form, it wasn't possible to write a kind of straight history of Xinjiang as Uyghurs had lived it or as Kazakhs had lived it, because that would get you arrested. It diverged dramatically from the state approved version. But, you know, many Uyghur writers talk to me about the ways that literature allowed the indirect expression of truths and opinions that wouldn't otherwise be acceptable. You know, the owner of an Uyghur bookshop in Istanbul, for example, I mean, he's been there years and years, and he has this vast library of Uyghur literature, some of which they're sort of busy digitizing and trying to preserve in the diaspora. But he told me the most popular books that he sold were historical epics, because Uyghur authors often disguise real events as novels, to write the things, as he said, that had to be written, but to do it in different ways and different names. And then, you know, at some point in the future, you could switch them back for the real names and the real names, the real dates, the real places, and have a genuine historic record. And then poetry too, it's, I think, fair to say it has a place of kind of power and importance in Uyghur and Kazakh culture, I think far beyond what we see in the English-speaking world. And there too, you know, symbolism and metaphor meant that authorities sometimes would allow that to exist, where more kind of literal writing would be censored.
Is that because some of the censors don't read between the lines?
I think absolutely, yeah. Yeah. And again, when we talked about cycles of repression, right, but when things did become more strict, it was, as in the Soviet Union, right, it was writers and it was intellectuals, some of who'd been allowed to work for years, but, you know, they were targeted and they were arrested. And that's all part two of the kind of general push towards assimilation that's meant that Uyghur language and Kazakh language is banned from schools, that bookstores and publishers are shut down as well. So, it's seen as a real threat.
Yeah, I read somewhere in one of the many books about the Cold War that I've read, and I've lost track now. I've got this point in my life where I'm like, I can remember certain things, but now I can't remember where I read it. But apparently in kind of early communist ideology, there's this idea that it takes 100 years to shift a population ideologically. And I don't know if you've seen anything in your research that kind of equates to that.
I'm familiar with that concept too, but I also can't quite remember the source. But
yeah.
If there is, I don't think I've seen it, no.
No, that's fine, that's fine. So people you profile practice quiet resistance through language, culture, and religion. Did that surprise you in its subtlety and power?
I think in a sense it did, yeah. I said before that if you're Uyghur or you're Kazakh, almost every part of your existence is political in one way or another. You know, the language you speak, the things you read, the names you choose to give places by, you know, the names you know them in your language versus the names, you know, the government calls them. And it wasn't, I didn't necessarily set out when I began writing the book to make this a theme, but the role that literature and poetry, you know, as we talked about, and the way that it empowers and sort of informs in the face of oppression, it inherently quietly ended up being this quite major theme, you know, sort of as a form of resistance. So it was a bit of a surprise, and it was so central to so many people. Syro, who I mentioned, I can't remember if I said, she's ethnic Kazakh, and the book opens with her, you know, her childhood memories of the Kazakh language books her parents kept hidden around the house. And she would sneak them out to read them for herself. And that was how she learned about history of, you know, the history of the region as it related to Kazakhs and her people, the stuff that wasn't, you know, taught in classrooms. And that sort of set the tone for one of the kind of forms of resistance that kept her going through the book. When she was arrested many years later, you know, police took all of her books, piled them in a pit, poured petrol on top, and then set them alight. And still fragments of them sort of lived on, because the woman in her cell passed these handwritten scraps of poetry between them, and sometimes even composed their own. And she said it, you know, it was something that helped them remember there was a world out there, that they were still alive, that they were themselves, that they were Kazakh. And before she escaped China herself, a friend gave her a poem of his own to memorize and to carry with her. So yeah, it was incredibly striking. And, you know, there's many other examples, but yeah.
The intergenerational trauma is palpable in your book, you know, from the Mao era persecution to modern re-education camps. How did families you spoke to make sense of that historical repetition?
It was something that came up a lot. Again, you know, we talked about cycles of oppression before, and that was something that, you know, I heard again and again. The targeting of religion, religious figures that happened during the Cultural Revolution, book burnings, as we just discussed, those happened then. They happened again in 2002. You know, some books on Uyghur history, yes, but also craft techniques and things like that were burnt too. But these were the Cultural Revolution, you know, these kind of things were stories that people were raised with, and that especially older characters saw repeating again in 2016 and 2017. And, you know, they were some of the people who saw the warning signs first, actually. But I think a lot of people saw the recent crackdown as not being an isolated event, but sort of rather the latest iteration of ongoing cycles targeting them.
Yeah, but what was the reaction to the younger generation of these things? Because obviously they don't really have the memory of the Mao-era persecutions.
I mean, they all remembered the stories, but I think perhaps they were... they wanted to believe it couldn't happen again. Not everyone, but some people did realize what was happening, especially those who were more familiar with history outside of the way it was taught in classrooms. But when fences started going up around housing blocks in 2016, when new ID requirements were brought in, when passports were confiscated, a lot of people understandably wanted to believe that this was just a passing bureaucratic phase, not the start of something more serious. But others saw that as it was. And I think partly informed by past events.
Yeah. How has China managed to justify this level of repression to the outside world? And why has international pressure remained so muted?
So the people in the book, and not only them, are labeled by Chinese authorities as you know, terrorists or separatists for these incredibly innocuous actions, you know, we discussed before. And that's, you know, really commonly the justification used, that this mass repression is targeting terrorism. And this isn't a recent justification. Further back, at the beginning of the war on terror, for example, authorities used the same kind of language to discuss other crackdowns. They sort of echoed and co-opted that political rhetoric coming from the US. I don't think it's necessarily been successful in justifying that to non-authoritarian states, as in I'm not sure that they believe it. Some have, as I said, you know, described it as genocide. And there were lots of fiery speeches condemning what China was doing in Xinjiang a few years ago. But China was able to wait for that outrage to blow over, which it did. and subsequently economic power has proven incredibly effective. The EU as a trading bloc obviously massively relies on China, and its policy now barely mentions Xinjiang. I mean, it gives China much of a pass for its support of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, so Xinjiang is barely an afterthought for them now, I think. But I mean, the many other countries too, predominantly Muslim countries included, you know, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, they've said they accept the Chinese version of events. And that's despite, you know, overwhelming evidence and Pakistani leaders often being, you know, very outspoken about Islamophobia in European countries. They just said, you know, we accept it. China's a close ally. Egypt carried out mass arrests and deportations of Uyghurs. There was AP reporting that China has black sites in the UAE that they use to hold Uyghurs. You know, Thailand deported dozens of Uyghurs earlier this year. And the same goes for a number of other countries. And there's been sort of genuine cooperation. So, you know, I think there's a number of reasons international pressure has really been, you know, quite muted. And yeah.
Do you think global economic dependency on China is creating a kind of diplomatic paralysis when it comes to human rights abuses in Xinjiang?
I'm not even sure if paralysis is exactly the word. Doesn't seem to be any real desire to confront this among a lot of political leadership. The US has been more outspoken, and there's various lawmakers on, you know, both sides of the aisle who've been passing relevant legislation quite recently as well. But at the top, you know, I mean, the previous Trump administration was, you know, described this as genocide, so did Biden. But now Trump's talking about tackling China, but it's not for human rights record. It's, you know, in terms of economic grievances and trade deficits. In the UK, you know, the Tory government seemed pretty keen not to alienate China. And Labour, while in opposition, said it would push a recognition of genocide. Now it's in power, it seems to have backed away from that. And there was a Guardian report just before Lamy's trip to Beijing that laid that out. I think once economic consequences of cutting off business with China or risking cutting off business with China becomes clear, the appetite isn't really there. And China's becoming more confident in using economic links as a cudgel, really.
I've certainly seen many MPs from both sides of the spectrum who at some point say something on the lines of that they don't wish to bring up human rights issues with the Chinese government. So it's not good. Let's take a break and be right back with more. Some of the people you spoke to found themselves monitored outside China's borders. And there's certainly been reports here of these sort of special police stations that are being set up around the world. There have been some in New York, in the UK. So how far does China's security state reach now?
I mean, pretty much everywhere is the short answer. I mentioned earlier that for people who went public with their stories in any way, activists or campaigners, I mean, also just people who posted on Facebook to say, you know, their husband or their parents had been detained, they were met with a massive response and a targeted response. And it was happening in the US. I mean, obviously, you know, they're China's main adversary. They have a formidable security apparatus of their own. But people still told me about having their addresses posted online, their children threatened, followed and surveilled, like on the National Mall in DC, within sight of the White House, while out shopping in malls, being physically attacked in the street, and protesters have been attacked too by counter-protesters. Bricks thrown through windows, notes pushed under doors, cars trying to rush to run them off the road. And at the same time, the cyber campaigns, government press conferences to denounce the people who, you know, former detainees who'd spoken out, sometimes making their own family members do it too, to call them liars. And it was so effective that, you know, Uyghurs in Virginia, where it's the largest Uyghur population in the US, some told me they wouldn't go to cultural events or religious events because they were concerned they might be seen and that would mean there would be, you know, reprisals for their family. But it's also not just Uyghurs and Chinese Kazakhs, it's Tibetans, Hong Kongers, various democracy activists targeted by the sort of the same system of repression. In the US, in the UK, people have told me about being followed and harassed. Elsewhere in Europe, I'm not sure if you saw the bounties that were placed on the heads of Free Hong Kong activists in the UK.
I didn't see that, actually. No, so talk to us about that.
I mean, it's essentially just, yeah, I mean, a bounty for their detention. But there were flyers, if I remember correctly, flyers posted through the neighboring houses of Hong Kong activists in the UK, suggesting that if they were handed over, there'd be a cash reward.
Wow.
So it's happening everywhere, right under the noses of you know, police and security apparatus.
Yeah, that's horrific. Going into sort of journalism and witnessing, what were the challenges you faced in gaining the trust of sources, many of whom were sort of trauma survivors and still in fear of surveillance?
I mean, we talked a little bit about this before. Mm. It was kind of this process of building trust over time. And, you know, lots of people didn't want to speak to me, very understandably, for their own safety or for the safety of their families. Some people wanted to be referred to only by pseudonyms, without identifying information.
Mm.
Some people had already gone public, and so felt, I think, that whatever was going to happen to them had already happened or would happen regardless. Serik Jambalash, who is in the book, he's quite a prominent human rights activist. He was already an activist when I met him, and he'd done so much human rights work. And he was very concerned about surveillance and had been publicly surveilled and constantly threatened, but I don't think for me. You know, it's this incredibly just tough decision, especially for Uyghurs and ethnic Kazakhs and other sort of Muslim minorities. If you speak out and try to help your people, sorry, rather you can speak out and try to help your people, or you, and by doing so, you essentially set fire to any chance of speaking to the people you love potentially ever again, and put them in danger too. So yeah, an incredibly hard decision.
Yeah, indeed. Have any, you know, fellow journalists, have you found, been targeted by the Chinese government because they've written articles about the Uyghurs, etc.?
I mean, I and many others have been subject to various degrees of campaign on social media. Mm. I personally haven't been contacted by anyone. I would think that Chinese authorities probably realize that if you contact a journalist, then they're going to record everything. And it'll be very obvious what they're doing. I mean, I've attended, you know, covered protests and been photographed outside consulates and things like that. But beyond that, no.
No. And do you think your liberty or safety would ever be at risk if you visited like Hong Kong or even mainland China?
I'm not sure I'd want to take the chance necessarily.
Yeah.
Perhaps if, you know, they granted me a journalist visa. I should say also, sorry, like talking about non-Chinese journalists here, If you're Uyghur, or you're ethnic Kazakh, or you're reporting on events in Xinjiang, then yes, you very much are in another layer of danger and likely so is your family.
Mm.
Sorry, just in addition to that.
Yeah, no, totally. That's a good point. So there's always a tension, obviously, between bearing witness and re-traumatizing subjects. So how did you sort of navigate that in your approach to this book and the storytelling of it?
I mean, talking about things like this is always, you know, it's a huge thing, and enormously grateful for all the people who did share their, you know, their time and their stories with me. And a lot of doing this is just good journalistic practice. You know, you want to be as clear as you can about what it is you're doing and what it would involve. In this case, very long, very detailed interviews, fact-checking over a period probably of years. And, you know, I outlined that I'd be asking questions that, about what were probably, you know, the most difficult times of their life. And alongside that, you know, questions that might seem a bit odd or irrelevant because you're trying to create this narrative and try to help the reader imagine exactly how things were. But, you know, you can ask what color the wallpaper was, what the weather was like that day, you know, what someone was wearing. And, you know, I made it clear that if they didn't want to answer any of these, that was fine, that we could move on, we could take breaks, we could finish up for the day whenever they felt like it. I tried to do interviews in places where the interviewees were comfortable and where they were in control, sometimes their homes, sometimes, you know, spaces connected with the community. And when I worked with the translator, ideally it was someone that they were comfortable, well, that made sure it was someone they were comfortable with, but ideally it was someone that they, you know, knew a little as well, just to try and make things as comfortable and as safe for them when discussing these, you know, incredibly difficult things.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, indeed. What do you most want readers and listeners to understand about life under authoritarianism from reading this book?
That this happened and it's still happening. You know, I wanted to communicate these stories that as well as I could. Mm. But, you know, as I said, a kind of really key theme, and this is something I wanted to get across, was that more than ever, in a very sort of interconnected world, authoritarian countries are able to, you know, exert their will all around the world. And that even if exiles live in a democratic country or, you know, very long way away from home, they might not really be free there. And, you know, more broadly, that this, I suppose, might seem obvious, but, you know, the rights and freedoms that we have and we enjoy are often not as secure as we think. And once they're taken away, they're kind of rarely given voluntarily back. You know, I said before, a lot of people assumed that things would continue as they had in Xinjiang and that these warning signs were not, well, a sign of something bigger to come. So, yeah, I mean, it's always human nature to not imagine that the worst is going to happen, but I think people should be aware that it might. Mm. And obviously, I don't mean people sort of pantomiming oppression about 5G masks or 5G masks or chemtrails, but yeah.
Yeah, 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 indeed, indeed. And do you think the international human rights community has any sort of real tools left to confront repression at this scale?
That we know what is happening is in, or has happened, is in no small part due to the work that human rights organizations have done. And there were some political changes as a result. I mean, that alongside, you know, survivors who were brave enough to speak out. But, you know, but knowledge isn't enough on its own. We know what happened and is happening in Xinjiang, just as we know the things that are happening in Gaza and that happened in Assad's Syria. But that hasn't been enough often to, or hasn't been reflected in the kind of political diplomatic action that actually might make a difference, that might make the perpetrators of abuses, of crimes against humanity, to sort of think twice about what they're doing. So I don't want to sound too pessimistic, but it's difficult to imagine anything that any human rights organization says or does in isolation that would cause policy change in China or Russia, for example. It needs to be coupled with concrete political steps, potential economic pressure. But, you know, as a kind of counterpoint, Serge Jambilash, the activist I mentioned earlier, his organization, Atajert, their work to publicize and campaign seems to have helped get, you know, many, many ethnic Kazakhs released from camps. So sometimes organizations can make a difference on their own. And that's despite Kazakh authorities attempting to stop them doing what they were doing at the behest of China.
Yeah. And what, if anything, gives you hope when it comes to the future of the Uyghur or Kazakh identity in China?
I think for me, it's more the people who are keeping culture and identity alive in exile. The writers and poets whose work is kind of more important, more vital than it ever has been. The bookshop I mentioned in Istanbul, where they're digitizing literature, and, you know, the shelves are full of works by authors and poets who've been disappeared and jailed and exiled and killed. There's a school there too that teaches in Istanbul, that teaches students in Uyghur. The cultural center in Virginia does classes in Uyghur language and dance and music. And there's people in Paris and London and, you know, many other places too who are doing the same as much as they can. And that's a living, breathing culture, not the Disneyfied version. And sort of as resistance, culture as resistance, and it's kind of facing off against oppression despite this unrelenting persecution. And that does give me hope, yeah.
Yeah. And just a random question. Obviously, for a lot of listeners, this is sort of a bit of a distant topic, but if anybody is sort of, you know, sort of concerned by this, is there anything on an individual level that listeners could do that might help things at all?
In the UK, contacting MPs might help. You know, people have been receptive, and there are certain MPs who are very active on this. There are local organizations, there are Uyghur organizations, there are organizations Hong Kongers, easy to find with the Google. You can make those contacts and you could talk to people. And, you know, I'm not really the person that should be telling people what to do to help, they could tell you.
Yeah.
So that's what I'd recommend.
Yeah. And what's the situation in the US with regards to this as well? Is there much discussion around this?
There have been various bits of policy introduced, including quite recently, but I'm not sure how much. Marco Rubio, for example, was very active on this in the last, and has been in the past. At the moment, not so much. This isn't the focus of Trump talks a lot about China, but like I said, the focus is trade. It's not human rights. So I think I don't want to speak for Uyghur activist organizations at the moment, but I think things are probably quite tough in making these kind of connections, or in generating activity from on the government side anyway, let's say.
Yeah, okay. Now, just sort of getting close to the end, is there anything on a more personal sense, has working on this book sort of changed your view of authoritarianism or even your faith in democracy?
I'm not sure. I spent quite a lot of time reporting on and living in authoritarian countries, and reporting on abuses by, you know, supposedly democratic countries too. But certainly it's reinforced my sense of the importance and value of genuine democracy and freedom. But, you know, as I said before, it's really highlighted the genuinely international reach that authoritarian governments have now, and the need to protect exiles, asylum seekers from that.
Yeah, yeah. Where can listeners find out more about you, your book and your work?
My book is just a Google away, but I'm not as active on social media as I probably should be, but I usually get around to posting new work on Twitter at JM_Beck.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.